I'm calling to order the Research and Innovation, Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. I'm just welcoming everybody. Thank you all. And just happy second move-in day number two, right? The meeting is now called to order. We are pleased to have our new Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Dr. Yvonne Harris, present as our newest member of the committee. Rachel, would you please call the roll?
Committee Vice Chair Rita Hathis. Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Montel Gales.
Here.
Trustee Tim Moore.
Here.
Board Chair Eric Wasowitz.
Here.
Committee Chair Veronica Herrera.
Here. Thank you. Mr. Perry, would you please confirm the appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Good morning, Committee Chair Herrera. Yes, you have a quorum present and appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. We have a quorum of trustees present and in person for today's committee meeting. Skip through a few things. Yep. Next, I will request a motion to approve the agenda as proposed.
So moved. Second, Gales.
Thank you. This is Barsima and Gales. Is there any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Next, I am requesting a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved, Gales.
Thank you, Trustee Gales, and a second from Chair Wasowitz. Is there any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, motion passes. Next, I want to welcome any University Advisory Committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
Good morning. I have no comment except to say welcome to Dr. Harris. We're looking forward to working with you.
Thank you.
You're good? Okay.
Yeah, I have no comment.
Okay, thank you. Next, we'll move to just a few remarks from me. And I want to acknowledge and give my personal welcome to Dr. Yvonne Harris. And on behalf, actually, of the board, I'd like to welcome you, being our first meeting. And I haven't met you in person until right now, so this is super exciting. She comes to us with such an impressive background, as serving as an NIU alum, and has just such a rich experience across different institutions. We're very lucky to have you. And you're a fellow Chicagoan, yes, which I appreciate. I just want to thank you for choosing NIU to be your community, and we just feel really fortunate to have you here with us. No pressure. Can't wait to see where you take RIPS. Really, I mean that. And also, I think I'm sure you have found is we have an incredible team with RIPS. And I'll mention, and I won't steal her thunder, but Darrow's always got like one of the best reports where we get to talk about like consistently like year over year increases. This time, I'll just say one small thing. 35% increase year over year in externally funded awards. And we've been sitting on a lot of HERF dollars. We're not anymore, and yet here we are, 35% year over year. That's just incredible. So I'll just make note of that. And we'd also like to recognize one of our amazing students, Jada Samuels, who I believe is here. Hi. She won first place and $7,000 at the DePaul University's Pitch Madness competition on July 19th. Congratulations. Ooh. Dr. Harris, would you please introduce Jada to our committee?
Welcome, Jada. Thank you. Welcome, Jada. Thank you for joining us today and sharing your success as an entrepreneur. Jada, please stand and be recognized.
Yes.
And would you share with us your year and what you are currently studying at NIU?
I am currently a junior here at NIU, and I'm majoring in entrepreneurship in the business field.
Thank you. We understand you started your company as a way to help people maintain healthier lifestyles and to promote generational well-being. Today, we want to congratulate you on your first place win, as well as audience favorite at the 6th annual DePaul University Pitch Madness Competition, held last month with teams from across the Big West. Huge achievement. We hope the $7,000 you won in prize money will go.
Oh.
We hope the $7,000 you won in prize money will go far to help you develop Jada Juice and bring it to scale. Jada, you exemplify what it means to be a Husky through your research, determination, and hard work to make your idea a reality. We wish you all the best as you continue your journey with NIU and beyond. Excellent.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the business?
Yes. So I actually started it when I was 17. As she said, it was to promote generational health amongst not only my community, but all individuals across Chicago. It's a smoothie company. All of my smoothies are all natural. They're dairy free. And I do that to put an emphasis on plant-based nutrition. I believe that everyone, despite their economic background, deserves access to high quality foods. So as of right now, I'm actually working towards getting my products inside of school cafeterias across Chicago, because I believe that if we instill qualities of healthy habits inside of the youth at an early age, it'll be more likely for that to carry down generations.
We can see why you were the audience favorite.
Thank you.
You should have brought some samples.
I definitely should have. I didn't even think about it.
Next meeting, yes.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Any other questions?
You've got your pitch down. That's great. It's very like authentic, and I love it. This is why. Right?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Next, I do want to, I think we all know, you know, the Governor Pritzker has made the EV, electric vehicle industry, a real priority for the state, you know, and one of the challenges we have is not just building out the industry and the infrastructure, but the talent pipeline, right? And how do we start this whole new, well, it's not so new anymore, but growing industry in Illinois with inclusion in mind, right? Equity and inclusion. And I'm really, really proud that NIU is playing a role in building an inclusive, you know, workforce for electric vehicles. So for those of you who don't know, Governor Pritzker, along with other leaders, were in Decatur on August 2nd to break ground on TCCI's new electric vehicle innovation hub. And NIU is one of the universities that has an articulation agreement with Richland Community College, which is also, they're also a participant in building this this pipeline, to ensure a seamless transfer of credits for students, allowing them to pursue their educational journey in these cutting edge fields without barriers. At our university, students will be able to transfer directly into our College of Engineering and Engineering Technology. That's a really big deal. And, you know, For those of you, there was an article recently about how, in the Chronicle of Education, how in Illinois we have work to do to support and encourage more transfer, right? Seamless transfer for our two-year students to our four-year universities. And I'm just really proud that we're taking the lead and being such a great partner for the state, right? As we look to build our pipeline. In quoting Dr. Freeman, She said, you know, NIU will offer a new training academy, is what we're calling it, with a focus on electric vehicle, advanced engineering, software technology, STEM pathways program, and an accredited apprenticeship program that will offer world-class training in electrification. So thank you. You want to say something?
I just want to add that the seamless transfer is not only into our wonderful College of Engineering and Engineering Technology, but also into the computer science and chemistry programs in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences.
Thank you. So it's great because, you know, equity and inclusion is often it's like an afterthought. We're trying to solve for it after we have the workforce. And, you know, with the partnerships that we have, we're going to be able to think of it as we're building it. So just thank you for being so forward thinking and equity minded. And speaking of forward thinking, we will be hearing from Dr. Thomas Chizinski. Did I pronounce that correctly? Oh, I'm sorry. I should have asked how to pronounce it before. Well, you will properly say your name when you introduce yourself later in our agenda. And he'll be talking to us about impacting Illinois communities through sustainability policy engagement. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your presentation. Thank you. Next, we will recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written requests to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, have you received any timely requests to address this meeting?
We have no public comment this morning.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to university reports. And I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Dr. Harris, for news items and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Herrero. At this time, I have nothing to add beyond what has been presented.
Thank you, Dr. Harris. We'll move to university reports then, with first our state legislative report with Ms. Is Katie on the line? Well, she's going to give us a verbal report.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to join virtually. My remarks this morning are going to be very brief since, as you know, summer is typically quiet in Springfield. And I've taken this opportunity to schedule on-campus meetings with our legislators, provide legislative summaries to our various departments on campus, and plan for the coming year. So we're gearing up for a fall veto session, which takes place October 24th through the 26th and November 7th through the 9th. Legislative liaisons began meeting in earnest in preparation for veto and spring sessions. And while the governor has vetoed a few bills, we don't anticipate any of those will impact higher education. We're currently collaborating with our sister institutions to develop a higher education legislative agenda, which will include building on the successful work from previous sessions. And we are scheduling meetings with area legislators to maintain communication and seek their support for higher education in the coming legislative sessions and beyond. You may have heard over the weekend that our representative in the House, Lance Yednock, has announced that he'll not seek re-election. So NIU will definitely see new representation in the House for the 104th General Assembly. With that, I will yield my time to take any questions.
Any questions?
Was that a surprise with Lance?
I was surprised, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That is surprising.
Yeah.
To me, anyway. Okay.
Anyone else?
And he'll be on campus in a couple of weeks for a campus visit. Okay. So we'll be able to talk to him a little bit more at that time.
Okay. Anyone else? We're good? Okay, thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Next, we will move to sponsored programs, the administrative report. Jared, I don't think we have any comments. It's just the written report, right? Okay, any questions from the board on the report that was provided? Okay, I'll go back to that. Any questions on the written report from sponsored programs? No. Okay, thank you. I'm going to go take us back to the legislative reports. Apologies. We have
Julia Rose, our new director of federal relations, and she's here to provide an update on that.
She is here. Julia. Okay. Where's Julia? It was to be a verbal or a verbal?
Julie, are you online?
I'm online.
There we go.
Oh, there you are. Sorry. I think there was a
That's
little
okay.
mess up. Would you like to provide your report? Apologies, Julia.
No problem. Yes. Hi, everyone. Good morning. My name is Julia Rowe. I joined NIU as Director of Federal Relations in May. Prior to NIU, I was Associate Director of Federal Relations at Northwestern University and worked in the University of California System Office in Washington, D.C. I'm excited to have joined NIU and look forward to working with all of you. I wanted to start with an appropriations update. Both the House and the Senate are in recess for their August break. When they return in September, they have a long list of priorities. Top among them is passing the 12 appropriations bills to fund the government for fiscal year 24. Due to ongoing negotiations and the legislative calendar, it is extremely likely we will see a government shutdown or continuing resolution at FY23 levels, when the fiscal year ends on October 1st. When Congress does reach a funding agreement, we are likely to see flat spending or cuts across the board and to NIU priority programs, including the research agencies and Title IV student aid programs. I've been working with the Illinois delegation to try to prevent these cuts. Congress has begun some of its work on several of the funding bills. Of key interest to us is the House Appropriations Committee, Labor, HHS, and Education Subcommittee majority bill that would eliminate the Federal Work Study Program and the SEOG, the Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant Programs. In the Senate bill, the Bipartisan Appropriations Committee would cut each of these programs by $10 million. These cuts are of high concern to us and a top priority for further engagement with the Illinois delegation when Congress returns in September, as many of our students rely on these programs and they're fundamental to higher education. Moving to a broader legislative update in Congress, higher education legislation has been relatively quiet this Congress. A few bills to note are in June, Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana introduced the Lowering Education Costs and Debt Act, a package of five bills aimed to rein in the cost of college and address affordability. This package has not had a hearing in the Senate Health Committee and is unlikely to have legislative movement by the end of this year. In regards to the Farm Bill, I've engaged with the Illinois delegation to consider food insecurity among college students as they work on the nutrition title of the Farm Bill by streamlining eligibility requirements for SNAP benefits. Moving to the Supreme Court, as you all know, on June 29th, the Supreme Court released its decision on affirmative action, striking down the use of race in college admissions. And on the following day, the court released its decision on the Biden administration's debt forgiveness plan, ending the administration's proposal of $10,000 and $20,000 debt forgiveness. After the court's ruling, the administration has now released a new SAVE plan, a saving on a valuable education, which is an income-based journal payment plan that aims to cut payments for undergraduate borrower loans in half. Looking ahead to the end of this year and into next, we have a presidential election coming in 2024. I expect Congress to slow legislating on issues of importance to us. However, the Department of Education is expected to release a proposed rule on gainful employment this fall and further action by the Department and the White House to implement the administration of higher education priorities is forthcoming. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I will say that we will address the Supreme Court decision in other matters. So if you have any questions about that, we'll get to that a little bit later in the agenda. But with regards to the rest of the report, anybody have any questions? Okay.
Trustee Herrera, can I just say how excited we are to have Julia on our team? Please. You know, is she said she has great background in higher education coming from the UC system and from Northwestern. She has Hill experience. She's worked closely with faculty in her previous roles. So I'm really excited to get the chance to work with her. I think you're going to enjoy working with her as well. So just want to welcome her officially to the Husky family.
Yes, welcome, Julia. I'm sorry our agenda was a little botched. If I knew that, at least my notes were. It's probably my fault. But normally I would have tried to give you a very warm welcome at the beginning, but hopefully this makes up for it. We're happy to have you here, and I really look forward to working with you more. Thank you. Thank you. If we don't have any other questions, we'll move to the next agenda item. And now I'm a little bit, we're gonna go with the presentation. Here we are. This is the, I don't know that I even have this. Sorry, Dr. Szczesinski will come to the podium and give us his presentation. Thank you. And you can correct me now.
No need. You actually gave it the pronunciation that's closer to the actual Polish pronunciation.
Okay.
So I think my parents would have been very pleased by that.
Thank you.
So I would like to thank the committee, the vice presidents, President Freeman, for welcoming me here this morning and giving me the opportunity to share some of the work that I've been involved in. My name is Thomas Szczesinski. That's a very Americanized version of that, I suppose. And I'm the director of the Institute for the Study of the Environment, Sustainability, and Energy. And today I'll be talking about impacting Illinois communities through sustainability policy engagement. Next slide, please. Or should I ask for next slide, or is there a way to click forward? There we go. So the agenda for the talk is pretty straightforward. I'm going to begin by talking about what is sustainability policy. I know a lot of you have been exposed to that concept, so this will just give you some insights into what I mean when I use that word. And then I'll talk about what is policy engagement. And then I'm going to turn to two success stories that I'm really excited about. The first is the NSF Advancing Smart Logistics Engine that was just awarded this year. And then the second is some ongoing work that I've been happy to lead with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources around land and water conservation. And with each of those, I'll be highlighting both how they link to student success and how they link to this concept of sustainability policy engagement. And then by summarizing sustainability policy engagement, I'll look to the future and think through with you how that can be a vital opportunity and pathway for NIU at the federal, state, and local levels. Next slide. So I already mentioned my main role, how I spend most of my days is as director of the Institute. We also house the environmental studies major. So this gives me a really good opportunity to connect with students, to connect with faculty on research, and I think most importantly to see how those two things can integrate with each other and with what communities' needs are around the state. I'm also a faculty associate in the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability, and I'm the chair of the Research and Collaboration Working Committee with the Illinois Innovation Network, and that's something that just happened this summer. My other role and why I first came to NIU was to be an associate professor of public administration. I was originally trained in urban planning and law at University of Michigan, and then I headed to Virginia Tech to do a little work in their urban planning program. And then I made the very intentional choice to come to NIU. This was originally my dream job when I was coming out as a doctoral student. I'm from the Midwest. I'm very much a native Midwesterner. And I was really excited to get embedded in a program that is so intimately connected with local governments across the state. And so these roles, even though it's a lot of hats to wear, and I know we all wear a lot of hats, I really view them as synergistic with each other. And they've given me a lot of insights into this idea of sustainability policy engagement and what it could look like going forward. Next slide. All right, so what is sustainability policy? Many people will first think of the environmental side of this, that we want to preserve and conserve our environmental resources. But there are two other components that are also very important to that concept. One is economic growth. We want to make sure that economic growth is compatible with that environmental preservation. And we want to make sure that the benefits and costs of decisions that we make as a society are equitable, that they're distributed in a fair and just way. So when I say sustainability policy, I mean policies that target at least one of those spheres while promoting long-term balance with the others. So it's a pretty straightforward conceptualization of it, and this draws from policy fields, planning fields, and some of the other social sciences and policy sciences. Next slide, please. So just some examples, at the local level, you could have something like a municipal climate action plan, greenhouse gas inventory, all of those things would be sustainability policy. At the state level, the Illinois Climate and Equitable Jobs Act would be a really great example of that. And then at the federal level, the recent Inflation Reduction Act is a very noteworthy example. And all of these are things that have been happening a lot more recently. So this is a very active policy space at every level of government. Next slide. All right, so what is policy engagement? There are a lot of ways to think about that. But we like to think of the policy process, especially those of us who work with local governments and state governments a lot, that it includes getting information, adopting the policy, planning around it, finally trying to implement it, hopefully successfully, and then evaluating how we've done so we can make sure that we do even better in the future. Sometimes that can be very linear, other times it's much more circular and kind of iterative and all over the place. I'm sure a lot of you have been exposed to the public sector and know just how circuitous that can be. And so there are really opportunities in each of these moments for engagement in the policy process. And that would be with the 24 state agencies in Illinois. It would also be with the over 5,000 units of local government that are involved in some way in sustainability, ranging from forest preserve districts to cities, villages, towns, what have you. Next slide, please. So clearly this sustainability policy engagement idea aligns really well with the university's goals. Of course, it aligns with Goal 5A, which is to advance NICS and sustainability initiatives. But I'm also hoping that the two success stories I share with you will illustrate how sustainability policy engagement supports many of these other goals, how it supports transdisciplinary scholarship, learning, and engagement. Next slide. All right, so the first success story, and I will say I'm equally excited about both of these. They're very different. The sponsor here was the National Science Foundation Directorate for Technology, Innovation, and Partnership, or TIPS, and the opportunity is being called the Advancing Smart Logistics Engine. This is a statewide collaborative effort, and as some of you may know, TIPS is the first new NSF directorate in more than 30 years. It's charged with advancing U.S. competitiveness and accelerating development of solutions to address pressing social and economic needs. So having NIU on the radar with something like this, something very new that clearly there's going to be a lot of investment in, is really exciting. The award was for a Regional Innovation Engines Development Planning Award for $1 million for 2 years. Next slide. And here you can see some of the objectives. I've highlighted the ones where NIU really has the biggest footprint and where our unique expertise can shine across a lot of the different divisions that we have at the university. So beyond these objectives that you see, and it's interdisciplinary applied research, business incubation and entrepreneurship, adaptive, lifelong, and P20 learning, cross-sectoral inclusive economic development, and deep community engagement. But beyond those, the overarching goal of these Type 1 planning grants is to build collaborative regional teams with the capacity to then apply for a Type 2 award to put these plans into action, to actually make advancing smart logistics a reality in the state. And those awards are for up to $160 million for 10 years. And I think the NIU effort is uniquely well-positioned to be very competitive for one of those awards. It would be truly transformative. Next slide, please. So not everyone got one of these. It was actually quite competitive. I had a chance to be on a lot of the calls, and it's interesting to be on a Zoom call with over 1,000 people. So there were 44 awards, and these were just the Type 1 developmental awards meant to springboard university collaborative efforts into the Type 2 phase. And so you can see here that there were surprisingly some states that weren't involved at all. My home state of Michigan, I was a little disappointed in. But having Illinois represented so well here and with NIU on that, that's really fantastic to give us that kind of visibility. They are all what I would call university collaboratives. So the lead institution had to be a university. There was especially attention from NSF to have it be regional comprehensive or minority serving institution, not just an R1. I'd say the Illinois effort was unique because of the Illinois Innovation Network, that it is really this holistic network, and I haven't seen something like it in other states. You might have university systems that are statewide, but you don't really have that connection across multiple levels of university. And as Trustee Herrero mentioned, and I hope I got your name right. Okay, thank you. It's not often that equity and inclusion are foregrounded in these economic development efforts. And I'd say like this is really an example of trying to make sure that that actually happens. Next slide, please. So when I say collaborative, I mean it was both collaborative externally and internally. I'm sure many of you are aware of the Illinois Innovation Network and the different hubs in that. 12 of them were involved in this. NIU was a sub-awardee on this. And even internally at NIU, there were multiple divisions involved. You can see the specific unit names there. But it was fantastic to lead an effort that bridged from academic affairs to OERD to ADEI, and to be recognized in these calls with IIN as as soon as you mention equitable workforce development, for example, NIU is the first university that's mentioned. It's not, you know, should UIC do this or should someone else do it? We are always front of mind on things like that and on adaptive lifelong learning. Next slide. All right, so the second opportunity, finishing up with this one. So the links to student success here and links to sustainability policy. So clearly there are going to be opportunities arising from this for degree and non-degree program development aligned with sustainable growth, which is really exciting. There will be research experiences in these opportunities for undergraduate and graduate students. And then I think most importantly, there will be visibility and impact in the communities that NIU students call home. So beyond just what they are doing immediately with the grant, they would have a way to see that NIU is involved in places that have been traditionally under-resourced and systematically disadvantaged. Now on the sustainability policy side, it's probably clear, but this is about deep engagement with communities and organizations to develop and change policies to improve job access for people from underserved communities. All right, now turning to the second one. This is the IDNR Land and Water Conservation Program. The sponsor, as I'd mentioned earlier, is the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. And this is a few awards. The one that just wrapped up was for FY22. This was an $845,000 award for grant review support. And then there have also a $500,000 award in development, and what we're hoping is another $500,001 for supporting statewide comprehensive planning and development of a supportive geographic information system for state decision making. So for anyone who knows GIS a little bit, actually I'll do it for those who don't. Imagine if you had a polygon that represented each park district and you had hundreds of pieces of data attached to that, and how powerful that kind of spatial analysis could be for a decision maker in figuring out what is the geography of opportunity across the state of Illinois. Surprisingly, this is something that IDNR does not have. We were kind of amazed that they didn't have it. And so getting a chance to help them develop that will be really rewarding, and it'll also be a resource for our faculty and students. Now, NIU works with state agencies a lot. We've had many contracts with state agencies over the years. The most important thing distinguishing these opportunities is that they primarily rely on supervised, mentored work by teams of undergraduate and graduate students. So this is environmental studies students and then graduate students from across multiple programs in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. In the FY22 award, more than $300,000 was for directly supporting students through stipends, scholarships, experiential learning, and other opportunities. And then in the upcoming award, the anticipated budget imprint for student support is $600,000. So this is funding that's not just flowing to faculty or to facilities or what have you, but it is actually going directly to our students to support them and give them really amazing resumes for grad school or what have you. Next slide, please. So the objectives on this included distributing $60 million to the acquisition and development of parkland statewide, with $15 million for distressed communities. That is the most the state has ever committed to distressed communities. We helped them figure out the formula for what it meant to be distressed or economically disadvantaged. Assisting with statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan, developing that GIS that I was talking about, and providing research fellowships to a team of 20 graduate and undergraduate students And that's, again, over $300,000. And that was for just the FY22 award, and we're doing that again in the upcoming opportunities. And then lastly, developing really essential mentoring and career pathways into state policy work. Next slide, please. So according to IDNR, this was the first time that they have had students of any kind, but especially undergrads, work on these kind of high-level policy tasks. It is very rare that a student would get to be a grant reviewer, to work on plans, to get involved in decision-making. As you can see from some of the photos, our students got to interact with Governor Pritzker. They met officials from the National Park Service and from IDNR. And one of the most amazing things to hear in all of those meetings was that the work was so exceptional that, one, the agency wanted to continue pursuing this kind of model with us, and two, that they were using what the students had done as a guide for their own employees for the level that they wanted them to work at. All right, next slide. Or wait, keep on this one for just a minute, sorry. So just to summarize this success story, there are several links to student success, funding them, helping them build their networks, and then most importantly, as I think with the other opportunities, seeing impact from their work in their own communities. And then clearly this links strongly to this idea of sustainability policy engagement because of what parks have meant to communities statewide, on public health, with regard to crime prevention, all of the benefits that we associate with those spaces. All right, so next slide, and this will be me wrapping it up, looking to the future. I'd like to look specifically at the federal, state, and the local levels and think about what this sustainability policy engagement idea looks like at each of those. Now, at the federal level, it's primarily about external funding opportunities that are increasingly requiring equitable public sector engagement and collaboration. We've seen this with NIH, with USDA, and with NSF, but also with some of the foundations like Robert Wood Johnson. There is increasingly an emphasis on transdisciplinary, use-inspired translational research. So that means thinking of the need first and the problem first, and then backing up to figure out what the solution can be and making sure there's that intimate connection of the work to that need. And then focusing on impacts for systematically under-resourced and disadvantaged communities. And it's really good to see these kind of priorities happening at the federal level. Next slide, please. Now at the state level, as I've already highlighted, many of the state agencies lost core policy capacity due to the pandemic. There is a need for contracted support in planning and implementation. And there seems to be new openness, especially from the work with IDNR, to getting graduate and undergraduate students directly involved in that work. And I could see where that could continue with Illinois EPA, with the Emergency Management Agency. There are really a lot of ways that students could get involved in the work that agencies are doing, and then develop these really robust career pathways. Next slide. And then finally, at the local level, as you can see on the left, there is a map of county governments and municipal governments. To say that Illinois has a lot of local governments would probably be an understatement. I'll spend a little more time on this one because I think it connects most strongly in my mind, and I think in many people's minds, to how the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability can become known not just as a hub for sustainability scholarship in general, but specifically as a hub for that use and need-inspired community sustainability research, work that is embedded in our counties, in our municipalities, and in our special districts, both in the region and statewide. A few highlights here. We do have a current contract with the Village of Wilmette to do their greenhouse gas emissions inventory. This was a collaboration that Courtney Gallagher and I worked to make happen. Students are involved in working on that, and we have interest from City of Oregon and Village of Northbrook and a few other communities who would love to see students get involved with working with their staff in the local government to make these things happen. So it's building that kind of capacity in our local units. According to the Illinois Municipal Sustainability Survey, which I originated and run from the Institute, very few governments have standalone sustainability plans or dedicated sustainability managers. So there are huge gaps for local governments in those spaces. And that also means there's big gaps for them with regard to how they can take advantage of CEJA and IRA and other opportunities at the federal and state level. All right, and last slide. So So from interacting with students on these opportunities, it is very clear that they care deeply about engaging in these ways and being active agents of change in their world. I don't think this would surprise anyone to hear about Huskies, but it bears repeating. There is growth in undergraduate student enrollment in the environmental policy and law emphasis within environmental studies. And through my connection with public administration, we're also developing an environmental policy management specialization. There are only 16 of those in the nation, so if one gets formed, it would be ranked immediately. Last slide. I thank you for your time. I really value this opportunity. I can say confidently that moving to NIU has given me a whole host of opportunities that I never had at an R1, that I've, from hearing from colleagues, that they've never had. So I appreciate the community that's been built here and the work that everybody has done to make that happen. So thank you.
I will open up to questions from the board, but before I hand it off, you know, the work you're having, or the work you're doing, is clearly having a great impact on so many different levels, right? From how we influence policy, how we support policy, like, and also how we're engaging, hopefully, even more students, right, in this field to then create more policy that is, you know, potentially more equity-minded and all that. Is there a way that you are sort of measuring that impact at like the dashboard level, right? So that we can talk about all the great work, because for so many people, this work is sort of abstract, right? But it's so real once you really think about it. So just wondering how you're thinking about that.
So there's a couple ways. Clearly there would be some internal metrics that you could look at about this. It would most directly be the students who are expressing interest in the environmental policy and law emphasis and then eventually enrolling in it. But there are many courses that deal with that topic embedded in programs around campus. And so I think having sort of a, I hate to use the word audit, but it would almost be an audit of what sustainability looks like, and specifically the policy piece of it. And I know that's part of the sustainability plan. I had a chance to be on the SCAP task force led by Courtney Gallagher. And so there will be metrics around that I think will be very easy to see. A couple other areas with the Illinois Municipal Sustainability Survey, that is the only state survey that we can find that actually covers municipalities statewide in a state. So the hope there is we've got a pretty good response rate. It's about 35%, which sounds like failing, but if you're trying to get local governments to respond to anything, 35% is stellar. So I think having over time data about what's going on with them, how they are connecting to the university, how they are staffing for things like this, when they are seeking outside help, it will give us a much better picture of where the gaps are and then help us think strategically about how we could hopefully fill those. And then the last one would really be looking at our research portfolio. So there's the basic research that gets done, and some of that can involve research experiences for undergrads. We're actually pretty good at that at NIU. I think having a measure of the grants and contracts that we pursue that specifically use the kind of model we had with IDNR and with some of these other opportunities would be really helpful. And then I guess the final piece is I talk to my students at the beginning and the end. They get surveyed, they get interviewed. We have some focus groups. All of the fellows who were still in school, so the ones who started as juniors, they all wanted to return. And so they were all very positive about it. They all had fantastic experiences. And so getting down to that human level, like, what has the actual experience been like? You know, what is it like for local governments that work with us? What is it like for the state agencies? That is just as valuable to me as any quantitative metric.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Others? Yep, Trustee Butler.
I have one question, and then I just have an idea.
Okay.
But the question would be, if we go back in your slides and look at the collaboration for the Advancing Smart Logistics, can you just help me understand the role of Undocumented Student Resource Center, just so I get a picture of how a student focused or centered activity gets pulled into this activity.
Right. So that's Sandy Lopez, who's the director there. And I should mention Brian Richard with CGS and Amy Jo Clemens with the P20 Center were the other individuals on this. So at least in the proposal, and I think there's a few ways it could go, but the way we described this was there are pathways into employment opportunities. So when an industry transforms, one of the biggest concerns is that transformation is going to leave people behind, mm-hmm. and that we need to be very intentional about ensuring that doesn't happen. So Sandy's office, the role that they can play is ensuring that students who are from those communities can connect into those pipelines. Traditionally, they haven't been, right? Those opportunities are foreclosed from them for a variety of reasons. And one of the barriers does certainly revolve around being undocumented. So because that office has done such good work already on that front, Sandy has great insights about how we can ensure that that's not a barrier to them being a part of this transformative change. So that when we're thinking about automation at our ports or truck middle mile freight or any of these things, that we're not leaving behind students. And it would be not leaving behind a lot of the students who are Huskies, who call NIU home. And so Sandy is very important to that. And then the P20 Center is really about that bridge that goes out into people's adaptive lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. So I would almost think of Sandy's role on the grant as like, how can we ensure we are not leaving behind our undergrads, especially from those communities? And then the broader role is, how do we ensure that this pipeline connects from, you know, all the way from like middle school up through people going back and reskilling?
In my labor world, we use the term just transition.
Yep.
For these issues, these matters. Thank you for that explanation. That's really helpful. The second point I wanted to make is more, I wouldn't say an idea necessarily, but just something that I think about a little bit when we're talking about public infrastructure and planning. There might be an interesting opportunity to bring in the College of Business or whoever is working in the area of public finance to see if they can't enter this space, thinking about how the entity would fund these projects, because that's, you know, that you can get them to plan it, but you don't necessarily have the millions of dollars to give them to do it.
Right.
And there's a number of loan programs, low interest loan programs, et cetera, but it's connecting the public entity to those programs, and maybe there's place there for people who work in public finance.
I think there definitely is. It's a really great insight, and when you interact with local governments, that is one of the first things they start talking about. As soon as they know that you're someone who's familiar with it, they're like, we can't budget for this, or we can't pursue a grant for this. There's kind of two things that could be helped there. So one, there's great public finance expertise in the public administration program. It's ranked 15th in the nation for that. Dr. Goodman, Dr. Thurmeyer, like they're all experts on this. Christine Mooney over in the College of Business, I think, would be very interested in getting involved on that. And so there's an opportunity for collaboration within NIU already and having those conversations. I also had a chance to work with University of Illinois Springfield. They had an effort that was meant to reach out to communities, bring them together in a common forum, and then allow especially smaller and more rural communities to learn about things like CEJA and IRA, all the funding opportunities, the things that they would need to make any infrastructure sustainability happen. There's no way they could do it with their tax base. They need outside resources. So building that kind of capacity and maybe holding workshops for communities in the region at NIU, it seemed to be a successful model. And now that we're mostly out of the pandemic, I think, we should be able to have opportunities like that. Mm-hmm. So thanks. Thank you for that.
Thank you for a terrific presentation.
Trustee Gales?
Yeah, I've got so many questions in this area. You know, my past is I used to build buildings for the city of Chicago.
Thanks.
And when you mentioned your definition of sustainability is this, it struck me that even in those days, there were 27 different definitions of sustainability.
There still might be.
And when I saw your presentation slides with the Venn diagrams and they had the overlaps, and you talked about focus on one area and then the other two, you know, show some care basically about those two. Isn't there a problem with coordination if you've got an imbalance of folks going after one particular area of sustainability versus looking at it more holistically?
I think there could be, but I tend to be pretty optimistic about collective action. I've seen local governments collaborate with each other. I've seen connections between public and private sector. When you have those competing interests, I suppose it's a question of intentionality and figuring out what people's competing interests and values are. And then hopefully having some time at the beginning of an interaction across sectoral boundaries to sort out, you know, like, what does triple bottom line mean over here? What does it mean in this local government? Even when you have two cities talking to each other in the same state, they should have like the same decision-making calculus. They do not, because you draw people in from many different backgrounds. So there is an essential component of this that is about, it's a dimension of cultural competency and sensitivity, acknowledging what people's backgrounds are, what their ideologies are. And then the one thing I think that everyone can agree on is that we want the benefits of growth to go to everyone, and we don't want it to harm future generations. And it seems like it's pretty easy to get people to agree on at least that as a minimum. Mm-hmm. And so if you have that as a starting point, then it's less about tension and it's more about resolution and conversation and collective action.
I'm going to give you an observational statement.
Yep.
And this is just based on some experience. Everyone wants sustainability. When they hear it, they think it's great until they hear price tag.
Right.
Or how much is of my budget is this going to require, even in my particular division or bureau or my unit?
Right.
John kind of raised a great point about the College of Business getting them involved. I think that sustainability is something that needs to be interwoven within the structure of the entire university.
I agree.
You need to understand that this is I'm going to use this word, I'm going to throw it out there. This is potentially a $1 trillion industry over the next 20, 30 years. And there's an opportunity to make money, but we oftentimes look at things within our own silos. You might walk into the room and say, oh, here's the sustainability guy. He's going to be asking me to spend this kind of money, right?
Yeah.
But they've got to understand that there is a rate of return for each discipline that you're involved in and making a decision to build that building I talked about earlier.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring this up. Part of the planning education at Michigan is you can get a real estate development certificate. Getting in the mindset of the developer and the time value of money and all of these things, right? It's very eye-opening, and it's something that I honestly wish more local government folks had that in their background so that they could understand it. When I teach students, there's always an entire week on what is the perspective of the developer so that you can work with them and negotiate with them.
And those folks are where the rubber meets the road.
They are. I think something that will be happening increasingly in the coming years, we've gotten better at doing sustainability more affordably. There are more projects. As soon as there are more projects, there are more best practices to learn from. The costs of learning and all of that start to go down. There's knowledge diffusion within the industry. So being a green developer now, it doesn't quite have the same startup costs that it used to. So it's becoming a little bit more affordable and accessible. We have a lot more really good models to work from. The place where I've seen this the biggest is in drinking water and dealing with, you know, there are places that have consent decrees where they have to, you know, figure out how to clean up what they're doing or put in new infrastructure. Instead of investing in this massive conduit that's going to just dump water into a river, they're daylighting streams. They're doing all of these things. I had an opportunity to work with the city of Cincinnati to see what they were doing in their greater metro area. And everybody thought to a person that it would be at least twice as expensive to do the sustainable option. It was 50% of the cost. It was changing that mindset and getting them to understand different ways to measure the rate of return, different ways to think about what your startup costs will be, models that you can draw from in other places. So I, it might be optimistic, but I do agree with you that it has to be across the entire university.
And one last comment. I think we also need to look at, do we have an epicenter kind of strategy where we look to see where our worst areas are for sustainability? I used to work for the CHA.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, it's the poor communities that are going to be lambasted with environmental disaster. We had a suit against us. We have a consent decree where someone poured battery acid in a play lot and, you know, contaminated the earth for so long. But the one thing I noticed in those types of environments, the folks aren't sophisticated enough to advocate for themselves, and they rely on people like us to go out there and say there's a problem, these people need to be compensated or corrected.
I think that's a really good point, especially going from that. One thing I didn't show in the policy process is advocacy, that is a piece of that in terms of setting the agenda, in terms of implementation. Some of the work we're doing with state agencies, I think, will help fill the data gaps so that they actually know what the impact is on communities. When we were trying to award the parks funding, this is $60 million in a year, and they do this every year, that's a lot of money. The way they thought about the social and economic benefits of this, they had no way to really quantify it or calculate it or figure out if they were putting too many resources one place versus another. And so filling that information gap is gonna be really critical. But I think you're right that there has to be an advocacy piece that extends beyond that. And we have a College of Law, we have a College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. Like, a lot of our units are involved in that in some way.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Thanks very much, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Yes, Chair Wozwicz.
Do you think we'll see our next building in the next?
I already said I'm an optimist, so I'm gonna say yes. I really hope that we do, and I do think something like NYX, it's unique among all of the IIN hubs. It's the only one that says community in its title. So I will be hopeful that the building will be there, and more importantly, that it will be self-sustaining and used in a way that is very visible. And I think it could be. I think there's a very clear model for how that could happen.
But,
I'll look at my couch cushions and see what I can do. From the conversations I've been in, I can't answer that. I mean, I could say 2 years, 3 years. President Freeman might have more insights. Vice President Harris might. So stepping back from the building, though, one thing the pandemic taught us is that a building is just a building. Now, there is some fantastic work that could be done with a new facility. But there's already work being done in this space. I mean, I've highlighted some of it. The Institute is certainly doing some. NYX as a group is already doing this. There are, I think, 48 faculty across campus who are affiliated with our Institute or with NYX, and they overlap quite a lot. The Environmental Studies major has well over 100 students, and there are other majors that involve them in the sustainability mission. So regardless of the building happening, there are ways to have impact. The building is not essential to the impact. I never viewed it as an end in and of itself. I viewed it more as a means to an end. And if we can achieve the same goals with, even if we're waiting for a building, that's going to be fine. NIU has figured out how to have community impact without having new buildings. So.
That's right. I appreciate your attitude towards this, because I mean, honestly, I was like, oh, we must have built a building already, because it sure sounds like it. But we're already moving, so far ahead. I forgot about the building. You're like, not me.
He has not forgot about the building.
Anybody else? Anyway, thank you so much.
Unless
anyone has any other questions. Thank you so much for your expertise and your commitment and all the impact you're having. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
Okay, well, I did forget about the building for the minute. You reminded me. And now I will continue to advocate for it, okay? good. Next, we will move to other matters. Are there any other matters requiring the attention of the board today?
Trustee Herrera, I'd like to brief the board on the case that Julia referenced, the Student Affairs Admissions case.
Please let us know.
bringing my laptop to the podium because I've gotten more senior in my role, and I'm not quite sure I can read all the stuff on that screen. So, good morning, trustees. I don't often get the opportunity to brief you on something of legal significance, but every once in a while, there is a case or law that gets passed or gets ruled on where the board should be aware of it because of your role as trustees, but also as the national conversation about higher ed churns and continues. You should be aware of it so as the dialogue continues, you at least have a sense of what the case is about, where we are now, and things to consider. So in Julia and her federal relations report, she alluded to it. In June 29th, there was a ruling by the Supreme Court in a case called Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and UNC. So what I want to cover with you today is just briefly to talk about the case, what the court ruled on, the latest guidance from the Department of Ed on how to interpret that opinion, and to talk about some practical considerations for universities. Now, to be clear, this is not legal advice, so this is not a privileged conversation, it's just an overview of the case so you're aware of it, and happy to take questions throughout the presentation, being mindful of time so I can make sure I respond to your questions, but also keep us on track for the meeting. So can I get the next slide, please? And the next one. All right, thank you. So the Students for Fair Admissions case, Students for Fair Admissions is a nonprofit group of about 20,000 students and parents and some other people who are involved who their mission is to make sure that race is not used in college admissions. And so they brought two lawsuits that moved their way through the federal court system to the Supreme Court. They brought a case against Harvard challenging their admissions process, alleging that it violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. Quick reference, Title VI is a federal law that says you cannot use race in decisions if you receive federal financial aid. Harvard, although a private school, still gets federal funds, so that's why Title VI applies to them. In response, Harvard admitted that they do use race as a factor, but that in their admissions process, they argued that the process was following the requirements set forth in what was the law of the land until Students for Fair Admissions, which is a case called Grutter v. Bollinger. Next slide. Similar case was brought against the University of North Carolina over their admissions process, very similar grounds, and UNC argued the exact same thing that Harvard did. We're following what the law and the Supreme Court passed in the Grutter case, and we believe our admissions process follows the standards set forth in that case. So a quick trip through con law that may be triggering to Trustee Gales, but there was a case in 2003 called Grutter v. Bollinger, and Grutter challenged her admissions to the University of Michigan Law School. She was a great student, had high GPA, high LSAT scores, but she wasn't admitted. And she argued that she was not admitted because of the university's use of race in the admissions process, and she was discriminated against. So in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court held that because achieving racial diversity on a university campus was a compelling interest, and the admissions process used factors, not just race, but many factors, that their admissions process at the University of Michigan was nearly tailored to achieve the objective of having a racial diverse campus, and they ruled in favor of the university. So the 5-4 decision, but until Students for Fair Admission, that was the law of the land. And essentially, that is the same type of admissions practice that the University of North Carolina and Harvard used in their admission processes. They use race as a factor, not the sole factor, but one of many that they considered out the process. So they believe they were on sound footing in the way they proceeded. Next slide. So on June 29th, and ironically about June 29th, I was at a conference of higher ed lawyers in downtown Chicago when this opinion came out. So at about 10 a.m. when the decision came out, I think we crashed the internet because we were all refreshing to read the opinion. I also heard the argument, the original oral argument back that actually took place on Halloween. And to be honest, the decision, if you heard the argument, was not that surprising. Based upon what we heard from the justices in the original argument, before the decision came out, it was pretty clear that the court, they were going to take some action to restrict race in admissions. The question was going to be how much and how extensive. So the decision by the court was that they said both practices at Harvard and UNC violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So what this essentially did was that race-conscious admissions were done away with after this decision. Next slide. So other important holdings that the court had, outside of just saying race-conscious admissions were no longer permissible, the court specifically ruled that in addition to race being prohibited from being considered in the admissions process, there was no compelling interest in achieving the educational benefits of diversity that would allow race-conscious admissions. That is a complete overruling of the Grutter decision. The court also held that diversity is not sufficiently measurable and could not be subjected to meaningful judicial review. They believe that admissions programs at both schools disadvantage some racial groups as opposed to others. And there was no logical endpoint where a court could determine whether diversity had ever been achieved. Now, one thing that did come out of the case, which is still a subject of discussion, but I think is pretty clear from the opinion itself, is that although an applicant's race cannot be used as a factor for admission, an applicant can discuss how race has impacted them personally through personal statements, recommendations from guidance counselors, to talk about how race has impacted their educational journey and their higher ed experience and how it's factored in their life. So that is still permissible, but it cannot be a factor that would give a preference in an admissions process. Next slide. So shortly after the Supreme Court made its decision and the opinion came out on June 29th, the Department of Ed weighed in and said that we're reviewing the decision and we'll provide some additional guidance as to how we're reading the opinion and provide some advice to schools. And that was through what typically from the Department of Ed, they'll issue what's called a Dear Colleague letter and the actual guidance of going through some scenarios of how they read the case and some of the areas that were not covered. Next slide. And this was important because although the court was very clear that race-conscious admissions were no longer permissible, the court left a lot of gray area in some areas that were very tangential to the admissions process into college enrollment. One of those areas, scholarship and financial aid, outreach and recruitment, pipeline and pathways programs, data collection, employment, and race-neutral strategies. So race-neutral strategies have always been permissible, but it was unclear as to how the court viewed race-neutral strategies and give examples of what was permissible and what wasn't. So although race-neutral is acceptable, people were looking for more guidance from the court as to what does that actually mean? What would you say is would pass the test by the Supreme Court that they would consider race-neutral? So these are all open questions, and the Department of Ed said we will look at the opinion and we will render some advice to help universities figure out how to move forward. Next slide. And so we got guidance from the Department of Ed, I believe about 2 weeks ago. And what they touched on was that colleges can legally work to diversify their student bodies through targeted recruitment, using race. They use race to double retention efforts. All the programs we currently do on our campus would be fine. So the issue that the court had was about admissions itself. But looking at the opinion, the court also said that universities can set their own mission. So if the mission of the university is to have a diverse student population, that is permissible. So the only issue was using race as an admissions preference, but if you want to have a diverse campus, the means to achieve that was up to the university if that supports their mission. The court also, the decision also discussed that, in outreach and recruitment, you could do targeted outreach and recruitment. Department of Ed also clarified that there was nothing illegal to collect demographic information on students, which is very important because you want to know who your students are for things like retention, who's being successful, as long as you didn't use it in the admissions process. In fact, the Department of Ed went so far as to say that admissions officers could actually look at race in the process, but they just couldn't use it. A little bit of a slippery slope, but again, the key ruling that the Department of Ed focused on was use of race of admissions. Next slide. Where we still have open questions is that the Department of Ed never clarified how this may apply to employers. And the opinion itself was 240 pages. There were six concurring opinions. And in those concurring opinions, each justice expressed their opinion of how they saw the limitation or the expansion of the ruling and how it might apply to other areas. And one of the hotbed areas is how it applies to employment. Because you follow the natural context and argument that was made in the admissions case, if you can't consider race in admissions because of federal law, it's a natural possibility to move to employment and say, you know what, you can't consider race in employment decisions. But neither the court specifically said that, and the Department of Ed didn't clarify that either. There's also no reference to how the Supreme Court's decision will impact race-conscious scholarships. There's been a tremendous effort to bring in students from underrepresented groups in areas that have historically been underrepresented, in STEM areas in particular, and there have been targeted scholarships based on race. The court did not opine on whether or not they were permissible, but in some of the concurring opinions, they suggested that any element of race in the process of a student's matriculation, whether it be in the admissions process or anything that flows from that, would not be permissible. And that's not the law, but that is what they opined on. So it gives some idea of if a case came before them, how they might look at it. But that's not the current law, but that is an open question and one that is currently being discussed, I think, throughout the country of how these are being, how these scholarships are being cataloged, how they're being reviewed, and what elements would pass scrutiny and which ones weren't. And the Department of Ed still didn't clarify that, so still the very open question. Next slide, please. So some of the considerations for colleges and universities in general, and I would say this is the vast majority, the Harvard and UNC decisions really impact a very small percentage of universities because these are universities that are very selective in admissions, always have more students applying than seats available. So their admissions policies and practices would be carefully reviewed because of that. But for most colleges, it's been very clear, use of race admissions is not permitted. Most universities have moved to a holistic admissions process to look at factors well beyond race, including academic performance, GPA, extracurricular activities, and some of the things you heard today in VP Renaud's presentation, students who've shown things in the community and want to be citizens, or students who want to be a part of the diverse community. All these factors into a holistic admissions process, so race hasn't been considered in most universities. So what is still unclear is what race-neutral alternatives are permissible. There's been arguments and inferences that targeted zip code recruitment would be permissible, but I also have heard arguments that by targeting certain zip codes, it really is a pretext for race because most of the residents in a certain community are in a certain demographic. So it's still an open question, and I think it's something you'll continue to see the question being debated. Neither the Supreme Court nor the Department of Ed clearly articulated whether federal financial aid and race-conscious scholarships are still permitted. This is also an open question where we will continue to watch, listen to guidance, pay attention, and see what happens. I don't know if there are any cases that are currently moving through the system, but the plaintiffs in the Students for Fair Admissions case, they have argued, and in every article I've read, they have said that they do believe that this applies to financial aid. So if they find a case, they're going to bring it through the court, and we'll see what happens. But right now, that's not the law of the land. But it is something to watch, and I think there could be a possibility of seeing a challenge to federal financial aid programs and a racial impact of whether or not it'd be permitted. Next slide. So some of the future implications are, again, around employment. I think that is the hotbed area. Again, making the same argument, if race can't be used for admissions because of federal funds, there's an analogous argument to possibly for unemployment circumstances. That has not been litigated, it's not been ruled on, but there's a possibility of something to continue to watch. Also, interestingly enough, after the Department of Ed issued their guidance and right after the Supreme Court decision, there was a group that brought a civil rights complaint to the Department of Ed challenging legacy admissions. An argument being made is that actually legacy admissions have been more detrimental to the enrollment in admissions of minorities in some ways than racial, removing racial consideration in admissions process. The argument being that students from more affluent families who are legacy students, and legacy is defined differently at other, you know, across universities, but generally speaking, legacy students whose parents are alums, but also are strong financial donors and supporters of the university, also receive a preference similar to throughout the admissions process where that gives them extra status in the process. And one statistic, if I recall from the case that is currently before the Department of Ed, Harvard in a typical class, up to like 28% of that entering class, students are legacy students. So almost 3 out of every 10 students already have a connection to the university. To trickle it down further, the argument being made is that not only would those students have the advantage because of the connection, they also have the benefit of going to schools that are more heavily resourced, more opportunity to take AP courses, even in extracurriculars, they have more opportunities to pursue things that will not be available to schools that are under-resourced. So the status of legacy admissions is something that's currently being reviewed, and the question whether or not it violates Title VI, that is a hot debate, and so it's currently a complaint with the Department of Ed, so it's not in court yet, but the Department of Ed is reviewing, and they will hopefully issue a finding, and that will provide additional guidance so universities can look at their processes for handling legacy admissions, because that's something not unique to Harvard, but it is something that you want to make sure that you have a process that's not unfairly discriminated against one particular student because of their background and not having those connections. And some states, I know Colorado, California being two of them, have already eliminated legacy admissions. And on the private side, I know Johns Hopkins back in Maryland also eliminated. So schools are looking at this now, but it's still very much an issue that's up for discussion. Next slide. So that is a brief run through. Again, it's not legal advice, but in most of your trustee work, and again, as you see articles and stories come out, I think you should be aware of it. But I am happy to take any questions now that you may have about the case or Supreme Court.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. One is, what are our current legacy admissions practices?
I will kick that over to my colleague, VP Jensen, and I think he can give a more complete answer.
Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say a huge appreciation to General Counsel Perry. He has been a huge supporter and advocate in bringing in all this information to the campus. So thank you to him, and he's worked closely on all of the various webinars and things that he's attended. We don't have a separate admission process for legacy students. We don't have a separate admission process based on race. We're gracious and love to have children of alumni attend. We do have a small award for students who are children of alumni, but it's not based on the admission at all. So it's our admission is solely based on their academic criteria.
Thank you. My other question is with regards to income status. And you mentioned financial aid, right? And I'm not sure if that is just, it's the same thing when I'm talking about, like, how does the Supreme Court feel about using income level?
They did not rule on that in the decision, but in some of the concurring opinions, the argument was that if race is a factor, it's not permitted. But again, that's not the law. That's just an opinion of individual justice. But I think it's something that we're all trying to figure out what that looks like. President Freeman, do you have a comment?
I guess I would say that if you look at history in the states where affirmative action and race-conscious admissions were outlawed, using class and income as a proxy for race has not been as effective as people would hope in maintaining diversity. One exception among all of the institutions is the UCLA College of Law, which chose to use wealth rather than income, and they were much more able to maintain a diverse class of students.
That's great, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Others have questions? Okay. Oh, yes, actually, Trustee Gales.
You know, you mentioned employment. It's also seeping into the contract world, because for those of you, you know, I'm always talking about minority and women participation within the university structure, but we just saw a case, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if it was U.S. Department of Transportation, has frozen the 8A program, right? Because there's been a challenge against that program. So I think what we have to do as folks that are going out and contracting for services is to anticipate what's coming down the road and to make sure that we start to create procurement programs that will allow for diversity, which will allow for that equity, because it's coming. It's coming, and it's foolish of us not to be prepared for that.
Yeah, and just one thing, and maybe President Freeman can address this, but with regards to scholarships and our donors, right? Like, what has our communication strategy been with our donors?
I might ask General Counsel Perry to follow this up, but I will say that for a long time, the Foundation and the Office of the General Counsel have worked to make sure that we simultaneously honor and respect appropriate donor content while not putting an unallowable preference into our scholarship language.
That's absolutely correct. That work started shortly after I got here. So we've been working closely with the Foundation, not just from the legal side, but just of that communication to donors, and also of our own review, just to make sure that what we're putting out publicly actually is what we have. Some of these scholarships that may have not been based on what is currently best practice are removed because they've already been outdated and just kind of have been out there. So we've already started that review, and there's a group looking at that, and we're actually just met on Monday, and we're still revising that to make sure we're in compliance.
Can I ask one other comment?
Yes,
question?
Please.
Has this ruling affected anything that we do? Nothing. Nothing has changed.
No, we're always have been compliant with the law. If anything, it just we were ahead of the game because many of the things we've done to make sure we achieve a diverse campus, like going test blind, we were already leading that. So nothing's changed. In fact, we were already ahead of this.
Okay.
Yeah, this is it's wonderful, I think, that you know we're able to attract such diversity. Without, you know, necessarily using race as a factor in our admissions. And it's just the nature of who we are as an institution and all of the wonderful work, obviously, that our enrollment and admissions teams do to recruit populations that I think, you know, really fit into the community. So that's a great, I mean, it makes us, it should make all of us feel really great, right? That the Supreme Court decision doesn't impact us. I hope it will never impact us, right? And that it doesn't go much further than this. But I think we all know that, you know, that's still a question mark. But thank you so much, GC Perry. I would appreciate your attention. Okay. Next, we'll move to the next meeting date. The next meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is November 9th, 2023, which feels like forever, right? Like November 9th. Wow, okay, well, we'll see you then. And we have 5 minutes between now and the next meeting. But we will start by adjourning this one. May I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All right. We have Chair Wazowicz with a motion and Trustee Barsima with a second. Rachel, will you please call the roll call vote?
Committee Vice Chair Rita Happas. Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Yes.
Trustee John Butler.
Yes.
Trustee Montel Gales.
Yes.
Trustee Tim Moore.
Yes.
Board Chair Eric Wazowicz.
Yes.
Committee Chair Veronica Herrera.
Yes. All right, well, the meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee meeting. Thank you.